Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, what can poll watchers do in Pennsylvania and how the pandemic has impacted Latinos in the state? But up front, for the last few years, the Pennsylvania state system of higher education has seen declining enrollments at most of the 14 state-owned universities. A significant shakeup is in the works to stem those losses. It involves consolidating six universities into two. Joining us is Dan Greenstein, Chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. Chancellor Greenstein, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Chancellor, provide some context on why integrating these universities is a good idea.
Sure. Thanks, Scott. So when we last met, or I think when we first met, we talked about the system redesign, which was conceived of in order to transform the Pennsylvania state system of higher education so that it continued to flourish into the 21st century and serve the needs of all our students, of all Pennsylvanians. As universities get smaller through enrollment decline, it is important for their students and their communities to still have access to the full breadth of educational programming that universities should be able to provide. And by integrating universities, we're able to provide, even extend that breadth of opportunity.
I know that this question has been asked many times, but again, for context's sake, why have enrollments been declining?
Oh, I think it's a combination of factors. Until recently, before the pandemic, we were in a full employment or near a full employment economy. The size of the high school leaving population has been declining. Students have a lot of choices, including online choices that they can take advantage of. So there's a variety of factors at work here.
But the bottom line for the state system is with that decline in enrollment, it also means that the universities are not bringing in the kind of money that they need to operate. Can you give us a ballpark figure of how much money we're talking about?
Well, 75% of our revenues on balance are made up of student fees, room and board, tuition, et cetera. So that's a fair chunk. And if our enrollments are down, they're down about 30% if you take out Westchester, which has grown over the last take out Westchester and Slippery Rock, which have grown or been stable over the last 10 years. So you can expect that level of impact on revenue.
Mm-hmm. But you don't. You said 30%. I mean, is there a number attached?
30% of our enrollments are down. Okay. I don't actually have the figure in terms of dollars. No.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Is it significant though?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
It is. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how, you know, I use the terminology consolidate and also integrate. Are we talking, are those the same two things, or are you looking at it more of an integration or a consolidation?
Well, we're looking at models for integration which enable universities to get together to become part of a single accredited entity. So it would be one entity recognized by Middle States and other accreditors, would have a single president, a single leadership team, a single faculty, a single academic program array. But the contributing or participating universities would also be able to maintain their brand, identity, name, et cetera, which is very important in our universities given their history and the passion for which they work with their local communities, their name and reputation.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But so where would the savings come? When you're consolidating three into one, actually six into two different, you know, locations. In fact, we should probably talk about which ones we're talking about. We're discussing here.
Sure.
There are two different consolidations.
Yeah, we're looking in the West. And remember, we're just in a review phase. We're just in a planning phase. So we haven't decided to do anything just yet. But we're looking at California, Clarion, and Edinburgh in the West. And we're looking at Mansfield, Lock Haven, and Bloomsburg in the Northeast.
Now, why were those six chosen?
So we're obviously looking at universities where enrollments have been declining and which are not able to provide, as a result of that, the kind of breadth of opportunity that their students need. Now, Bloomsburg is not in that category. It has been relatively successful over the last many years. But it also has powerful programs, which in combination with what's available at Lockhaven Mansfield potentially allows us the opportunity to build a real public university powerhouse in the Northeast. And the Northeast, by all accounts, could very well benefit from that sort of thing. In the West, same sort of issues apply. California, Clarion, Edinburgh together, very complementary in terms of the program mix, potential interesting alignment with respect of culture. There's proximity in both of these cases, Northeast and West. That's important. And they both get to an enrollment size of about 12 or 13,000, which is also significant. It seems that at that level, it will be possible to expand the breadth of student opportunity.
Obviously, we're talking about three universities west, three in the east. What part did geography play in this at all?
Well, I think in terms of the combinations themselves, Scott, I think proximity does matter. We're looking at ensuring that instructional activity, residential activity goes on in each of the universities, and so some ability to do that in both face-to-face and hybrid forms will be critical. That's easier to do where universities are located not too far from one another, harder to do if they're completely across the state.
Mm-hmm. Now, you described where some of the savings would come with one single administration, that kind of thing. But I want to get into that a little bit more. One thing that, it's obvious that there will be some faculty job losses, staff job losses as well. In fact, the union representing the faculty said there would be about 300 jobs that would be lost. You agree with that figure? And, is that a significant savings there?
So a couple of things. So first of all, integration is a very long process. We're just in the middle of a planning phase at the moment. That planning phase won't be done until at least April. The soonest that the Board of Governors could take a decision about integrating universities wouldn't be until July 2021. And then the soonest a newly integrated university could open its doors to a new cohort of students wouldn't be until August 2022. So this is a long process, and the planning has not ensued. We're just beginning that process to figure out, how it would look and how do we get there. So I don't actually know what will happen at the other side. There is a significant effort at the moment to address our financial circumstances by basically aligning, we talked about it a moment ago, aligning our costs with our revenues. Obviously, as we mentioned, our revenues are impacted by 30% enrollment decline. We can no longer operate at the same size that we once were when we were a much larger university. So our expectation is that we will align those costs and revenues in advance of integrating our universities. So those two things are separate, at least in my head. They're sequential, if that makes sense.
But there would have to be some faculty job losses. I mean, that just seems that it would make sense.
As a result of the integration, I can't say yet, Scott, simply because the planning really hasn't taken place, and so I don't want to preempt what might materialize as a result of that.
Well, but, Chancellor, let's be honest about it. I mean, if you're going to have three universities combined into one, there aren't going to be as many classes and need for faculty as there would be with three separate universities.
So I think, maybe the difference here is that we're talking about it in very different terms. I think you're talking about integration as if it were a means of driving efficiency and another austerity measure. I actually don't see that. I see integration as an opportunity to expand the kinds of programs that we're able to offer our students. So our universities in the West, for example, are looking at obviously bringing together their institutions in a way that provides all of them an opportunity to give students traditional residential programming, on-site, on campus. They're also looking at standing up fully online undergraduate degree and degree completion program, which is a growth area for the state system and, frankly, one which is in high demand in the state. Similarly, in the Northeast, our universities are pursuing a strategy which will enable them to pull complementary programs together so that students can continue in a very traditional residential way in each of the universities, but at the same time branching into a short course certificate and other non-degree programs that serve directly the needs of employers in that region. So in both these regards, these are strategies that enable us not just to grow for the sake of growth, but to grow for the sake of serving the state and its students in ways which the state and its students need uniquely in the 21st century, which they perhaps didn't 20 and 30 years ago.
See, I'm glad you clarified that because, yeah, I think a lot of people, when you're talking about declining enrollments, not as many students, think right off the bat, okay, this is an austerity measure that we're looking for ways to save money to be more efficient. But when you're talking about expansion, so that expansion, offering new programs, new majors maybe, that's what you're counting on to attract new students?
Absolutely, and it's what the state is counting on from its public universities. I mean, think about it. The demand for the kind of education which we offer and which we're very good at, you know, the kind of education which is traditional, residential, comprehensively based, is declining, and it has been for well over a decade. At the same time, demand in this state and in others for online and hybrid forms of instructions in the degree space, but increasingly also from adults who are not looking for degrees and certainly not for residential degrees, but looking to upskill and reskill through a variety of short course credentials is growing. And none of those people right now have very much of a public option. And we as a public system, as a system of public universities, in my view, have an obligation at least to look at those students and to look at that demand and ask ourselves the serious and searching questions about whether or not, as the public universities of this state, have an obligation to serve those students. I believe that we do.
Would you be competing with community college in that way?
I don't believe so. I mean, so if you think about the, again, you know, and I testified in this regard to the Higher Education Funding Commission a few months ago, the way we think about education is we think about it in little boxes. There's elementary and there's secondary and there's community colleges and then there's 4 years and there's a bunch of different flavors of 4 years. There's research 4 years and there's non-research 4 years, right? The way a student thinks of education is as a journey. Right. It is. And increasingly that journey sees them going back and forth between education and the workplace, between education and the workplace over a lifetime. Right. So the way students think of education is in terms of pathways. And so what we have done by putting big sectoral boundaries around our schools and around our colleges is made very difficult transitions for our students. So we're looking at a world in which students can travel along pathways between community colleges and universities and then perhaps back into community colleges so they can continue to improve their ability to compete effectively in a very dramatically changing labor market. So if you look at it that way, there's A, more work, there's more for everyone to do, certainly enough for everyone to do, but more importantly, we can provide well-constructed pathways so that students know where to go next in their journeys. I know it's a little bit of an orthogonal view and a different view to get one's head around, but it's the view that our students and our employees, our workers actually demand of us right now.
So, again, I'm trying to picture this for the listeners and Pennsylvanians who may not be familiar with what this will look like in the future. The six universities that will be integrated into two, will there be two? Will be there be new names for these two new institutions?
So certainly the contributing universities, if we go ahead with integration, will maintain their own names. And that's important, again, giving our legacy, our brand, and our history and the attractiveness that our universities have to their communities and vice versa. Whether there will be another name for this entity into which they to which they contribute, that also remains to be seen as part of the planning process. And certainly our accreditors, the Middle State Commission of Higher Education, will have a view of all this, and we're working, obviously, very closely with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, maintaining these identities, most people, or I shouldn't say most, many people will think about athletics, will think about activities that identify an institution. Will these six institutions maintain their own athletic programs, their own identities when it comes to other activities and ways they compete?
So again, I can't say because this is, you know, getting ahead of where we are in the planning process, it just having started about last week on Monday for this detailed part of the planning process. Having said that, though, one of the things that's fascinating about this process is it allows us to ask the question in a way that you've just asked, which is identity is important. Good. Okay. What is it that contributes to a university's identity? Is it athletics? Is it the name? Is it the color scheme? Is the math? You know, there's a whole range of things that contribute to a university's identity. And, of course, working with stakeholders, and we will, alumni, community leaders, as well as obviously internal stakeholders, faculty, staff, et cetera, councils of trustees, legislators, will be able to ask that question. What is it about this university's identity, which is absolutely essential? Because once we know the answers to those questions, we will be able to say, okay, if identity is important and those attributes, and maybe athletics and maybe many other things as well, are critically important, then we will do everything in our power to preserve them, because that is what contributes to identity. But I think it'll be fascinating to know what does and what does not contribute to a university's identity, and then use this information to ensure that we're designing in a way that enables our students to have the most opportunity that they can possibly have access to.
Chancellor, I'm going to ask a question that, again, maybe sure. I'm a little bit too far ahead, since this only, as you said, was discussed last week. But I kind of was picturing something like Penn State and Penn State satellite campuses, that there would be one name, and then in the east, Bloomsburg campus, Mansfield campus, in the west, California campus. I mean, is that a possibility?
No, not at all. In fact, we're specifically not pursuing that model, not because the Penn State model is a bad model or that Penn State obviously works very well. It's just that that would not permit us to maintain the identity and the sort of the co-partnership of the participating universities, which is absolutely essential to us. Penn State sort of began in a very different way. It began at the center and built the Commonwealth campuses. Our universities all grew up independently over a very long period of time. So we're looking at a very different set of circumstances, so as a consequence of a very different model.
I want to give an example here. See, a student attending Bloomsburg, for example, will that student still physically live on campus at Bloomsburg, but will they attend some classes in person in Bloomsburg, on the Bloomsburg campus, and then maybe take some online campuses from the two other universities?
I can see all sorts of possibilities. And again, this is something we're obviously going to be looking into, and I wouldn't want to foreclose on any options. So certainly hybrid options like the one that you have described are certainly possible. I can also be possibilities where there's, different residential models. You know, we think about having a term abroad. What you can imagine having a term at Namur University. You can imagine developing degree programs and program pathways, which see students very deliberately moving from one place to another as they pursue their course of study, maybe moving physically, maybe not. But all of those options are really being thrown on the table. Again, what we have an opportunity to do here, and this is actually the excitement of it all, is to reimagine what education could be and should be through the eyes of our students. Not through the eyes of our institutions and their history and their legacy, although that's very important and there's so many important lessons to learn, but we have an opportunity to refashion higher education, public higher education, as it ought to be in the 21st century. The other thing I'd throw in here, and it's very important, is that what our universities are doing that are involved in this process, they're not just thinking about, expanding opportunity in terms of program breadth, they're also thinking about how can we open up that gap that we once had in terms of the affordability of our institutions. Can we actually make the experience that we offer less expensive in terms of net average price a student pays? This is absolutely critical for a public higher education. And these are the kinds of questions that we have an opportunity now to entertain.
Well, you just touched on what many people will be wondering, how this will impact students and their families' cost, tuitions, housing, those kind of things. Any idea how it will impact those things?
We have to get less expensive overall. This is true across higher education, but it is critically important for our public university options. And obviously the state has a role to play here. This is a partnership with the state. We are doing our part to be as effective as we possibly can in delivering the highest quality range of student opportunities. The state has a role to play as well in terms of their partnership and support, recognizing, of course, the significant challenges that the state and other states are under at the moment. And yet that partnership at some point needs to continue to strengthen as it has been strengthening over the last several years.
So, Chancellor, would you once again go over the timeline? As you said, this is still in the planning stages.
Yeah, and the timeline is defined in Act 50, which is a statutory authority given to the board for a limited time to enable the board to pursue integration. Right now we're in a planning phase, a detailed planning phase. It runs at least until April, and it will answer all the questions and many others that you have been asking about, okay, what will it look like and how will we get there? That proposal could be submitted, or those proposals could be submitted to the board at the earliest in April. That would trigger a 60-day public comment period, so the soonest the board could take an action to integrate universities would be in July 2021, and the soonest an integrated entity could enroll its first cohort of students would be August 2022. So this is a very long journey that we're on, and we're just at the earliest stages, and it's very exciting.
Before we leave each other today, I do have one other issue I want to bring up. Spotlight PA reported this summer that even though the state system has made strides in attracting more students of color, many say they're not supported once they're on campus. They say many students of color said they felt unwelcome and ill-supported, at worst, unsafe and targeted. Last week, Senator Art Haywood of Philadelphia said addressing this issue should be a priority with any reorganization that you're doing. Will it be, and how?
It is a priority, and it has been since the system redesign was first put in place. Ensuring that higher education across the country is a diverse and equitable and inclusive place is absolutely critical for all sorts of reasons, for the humane and ethical reasons that, you know, one could turn to, for eliminating, you know, historic social injustices and racial injustices that have been with us for hundreds of years, but also because higher education is about creating pathways to social mobility. And unless we overcome those significant and nagging and persistent obstacles, we cannot fulfill our mission in that regard.
But how are you going to do that? I mean, when you have students who say that they felt unwelcome and they don't get enough support, how are you going to do that?
Well, so there's a variety of things going on. So it's not a new idea. Our campus has been very active. Our universities, our leadership has been very active in this regard. All of them have programs, all of them headed by vice presidents who sit at the leadership table, looking at a variety of different strategic objectives. They include putting in supports for students, in academic as well as other advising supports. They include, you know, efforts to diversify faculty and staff so that faculty and staff increasingly look more like the students of Pennsylvania. They include developing cultural competencies so that faculty and staff and students, frankly, are used to engaging in multicultural environments. There's some exceptionally good programming across the system. There's a great program called the Free Speech Project at Indiana University of Pennsylvania, which is, I think, exemplary nationally in this regard. So there's a variety of sort of strands. But recently, you may know, in light of all this, in fact, in late spring, early summer, in response to the considerable effort underway at our universities, I appointed a vice chancellor for diversity, equity, and inclusion who will help to channel and focus and coalesce those substantial efforts that are going on across the system. And we're seeing some progress, I have to say, Scott. We've seen an uptick in some of our student success, our retention. We have consistently now, over the last couple of years, made sure that we look at all of our information on students and student outcomes and on faculty and staff through a kind of equity lens. In the technical terms, we disaggregate the data so we can look, you know, immediately at any differences that exist between white, black, and brown students and, frankly, faculty and staff. So by illuminating this kind of issue, and I think Senator Haywood did us an enormous favor, as did the Spotlight PA article, by continuing to shine a spotlight on this issue, it keeps us honest and, frankly, our feet to the fire in terms of addressing it. It's very important.
Dan Greenstein is the Chancellor of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. Chancellor Greenstein, thank you very much for being with us today.
And thank you.
I'm sure we'll be talking about this again. You're listening to Smart Talk on WYTF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Throughout the last weeks of the 2020 presidential campaign, President Donald Trump has warned about voter fraud and irregularities that could lead to cheating. The president has encouraged poll watchers to show up and observe voting. That raised concerns of voter intimidation. But there are laws in place in Pennsylvania about poll watchers, what they can and what they can't do. WITF's Emily Previty recently reported on poll watchers for Spotlight PA, and she joins us today. Emily, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
All right, so what is a poll watcher?
So a poll watcher is someone who's appointed by a political party or a candidate's campaign to monitor in-person voting on Election Day. So they'd be looking for irregularities such as problems with machines or campaign materials inside of the voting area, things like that. They need to have a poll watcher certificate too. And those are issued by county election offices. Counties might be issuing certificates into Election Day, but some have earlier deadlines and check to make sure that the poll watcher is a registered voter in the county where they're working, because that is required by state law.
Okay, so you've just touched on a few things here, but I wanted to discuss what poll watchers can do and what they can't do.
So poll watchers, there's really more about what they can't do, because they're really just supposed to be there to observe. And if there's something that they see that's concerning, they're supposed to wait until the election judge or election workers running in-person voting aren't engaged with the voter, and then bring that concern to them. They are not supposed to directly engage with voters by talking to them, by asking them for ID or other documentation. They're not supposed to hover, according to Department of State guidelines. They have to keep a safe and respectful distance from individual voters, which we can get into more specifically in a minute. And as I said, the Department of State guidance lays out what does rise to the level of voter intimidation. And as a poll watcher, they're supposed to be familiar with that county's rules in addition to state law. So state law also limits poll watchers to 2 per candidate per precinct, with only one of them allowed inside the voting area at any time. And for a political party, it's 3 watchers per precinct, with one allowed inside it a time. So that's another thing. They need to stay outside unless they're one of those individuals designated to be inside at that time.
So clarify something for me. Those people that we've all encountered outside the polling place that are handing out candidate information or literature, are those poll watchers, or are they just working for the campaigns?
So very often they are poll watchers in practice. And what you're seeing is, they're working for the campaign, but when they're out, they're far enough away, basically, from the voting area and from, the inside part of the polling location to be able to do that. If you're within a certain distance of the voting area, you cannot engage in electioneering, which, like you said, is handing out literature or really doing anything to support a particular candidate or party.
Mm-hmm. So the poll watchers inside that where the voters are actually casting their ballots, can they talk to voters?
No, they cannot. They cannot directly engage with voters. They're not supposed to. That's okay. What the guidance from the Department of State says.
All right. You said we'll get into some more specifics. What are some of those specifics that you're talking about and referring to?
Well, I was referring to the distance issue, Scott. So, there's a specific distance for, that the poll watchers are supposed to stay back from the voting area itself. That's 10 feet. But state law is less specific when it comes to how far poll watchers should be from, let's say, voters, right? And I believe the guidance says safe and respectful, which that's not very specific. So counties, some of them have defined this. Chester and a couple others say it's 6 feet. You also have a few more who designate a specific area, like a table, where poll watchers need to stay. So a lot of the specifics that we're talking about come down to the county level. And again, it's on the candidate, campaign, the political party, and the poll watchers themselves to know those rules before they go out on Election Day.
So if a poll watcher sees something that they feel is irregular, or they have a question about someone who is voting, what can they do?
So now you're talking about the poll watcher having a concern?
Right.
Right. Okay, sorry. I just wanted to clarify, because poll watcher, poll worker, I don't want to confuse them.
We want to talk about that, poll workers, too, but in this case, poll watchers.
So they're supposed to wait until the election judge is not busy helping a voter, and let them know what their concern is and let the election judge take it from there.
So would it be up to the judge of elections then to make a decision about whether to go further with the...
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
And if they have an issue with that, they can, you know, they think that the judge made the wrong call, they can always go to the main county election headquarters or call to try to get directly to the county election director.
The Trump administration wanted more poll watchers in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia in particular. Why did they want more?
So this is, we've heard the president raise, some may call them concerns or strong critiques. Other might say it's attempting to undermine our election system's integrity generally. But basically, we know the president's made these extremely strong statements on voting by mail, for example. And this is more, the poll watcher comments are more directed toward in-person voting. We know specifically regarding Pennsylvania, he said he can't lose states unless Democrats cheat. Although we should note there are more Democrats registered to vote in Pennsylvania than Republicans. But this targeting of in-person voting and saying more poll watchers are needed to make sure Democrats don't cheat, basically. And with the Philadelphia situation specifically, election officials were not letting poll watchers into satellite voting offices where voters can deal with registration and ballot requests and even cast their ballots or drop them off. And because the watchers were not allowed in, that's what the president was referring to during his first debate when he said bad things happened in Philadelphia.
There was a court ruling there. What was that court ruling about the satellite offices?
So, that was thrown out. His campaign's attempt to sue over this in Philadelphia was not successful. The campaign also filed, as we know, a federal lawsuit that was thrown out a few weeks ago, where they also, some of the relief they were seeking would have given campaigns more flexibility in assigning poll watchers so that they can work anywhere in the state rather than just the county where they're registered to vote.
Mm-hmm. So if someone is a poll watcher, say in Dauphin County, that person, voters can be assured that person is from Dauphin County.
So some counties verify that nominated poll watchers are registered to vote in that county. Some do not. Dauphin, at last check, I was told they don't perform that vetting process. But so it's on the campaigns in that case to have verified the watcher is, in fact, a registered voter in that county.
I have to, I don't know whether you can answer this or not, Emily, but what's the reasoning behind that goal? I mean, if someone's a Pennsylvanian from another county, why does the law say that they are supposed to be, the poll watcher should be from that county where people are voting?
So part of it is, I mean, the concern about voter intimidation, having, and this is a particular concern in areas that are predominantly populated by people of color, and that's come up, that came up in the 2016 election as well, concerns that you would have voters coming in from outside counties to try to intimidate voters. And so that's part of it. And also, you know, it's a familiarity thing as well. You would recognize your neighbors potentially, or it's people that you know who are doing this. And that's, you know, it's along similar lines with state law's allowance or requirement that ID can only be requested the first time you're voting in person at a precinct, right? So those are two of the underlying reasons, but I don't have more specifics beyond that.
And that's what I figured, but I really never heard an explanation. If a voter does feel intimidated by a poll watcher, what recourse do they have?
So they, too, should let the judge of elections know at the precinct, and they also should follow up with their district attorney and just, you know, get it on the record, file a report.
I mean, do we have cases, have we had cases here in recent times of voters feeling intimidated by poll watchers?
Not very recently, but, you know, I've been focused on this issue sporting in Pennsylvania only since 2013. So I don't recall learning about that happening, particularly not on any widespread scale, prior to this being my beat, and certainly not since. So I'm not aware of anything in recent history.
Emily, you just answered this question partially, but we had a listener ask, you know, what recourse does a voter have if they feel they're being intimidated? But the second part of the question, or if they see a poll watcher do something that they think is wrong.
So it's, you know, it's again letting the judge of elections know, the county election office know, by placing a phone call or stopping by in person. So it's a similar guidance.
Okay. You know, one of the things that has concerned a lot of people is that there will be people who will show up at the polls who are armed. Whether, you know, depending on them, you know, whether they are, I don't know, I'm not going to describe what they're, you know, what they're looking like or anything like that, or part of a group or anything else, but that they are armed, and it's obvious that they are armed. What does Pennsylvania law say about that?
So, to simplify it, you can have firearms at a polling place if you have the proper credentials and permits to do so. There are some nuances and more specifics to that, and actually, Joseph Jafari from Spotlight, who I collaborated on the Poll Watchers initial story with, and Brett Schultes of WITF are currently reporting a story that I'm expecting is coming out sometime quite soon that delves into those specifics.
Mm-hmm. But I just can't picture a scenario where someone with a gun in a holster can walk into a place, whether a poll watcher or not, and be able to vote while they're armed.
No, you're right. And I think that it strikes many people that way, which is the reason that they're doing the second story. So I'm sure as adults, you know, detail that, but again, that story hasn't come out yet, and they're looking at the specific nuances of the law when it comes to firearms at voting locations.
One more question here from a listener, Emily. It says, once the votes leave their local polls to be counted at the county seats, are the measures taken to continue the integrity of the vote count? Do political parties have an equal number of individuals watching the final count?
No, it's not an equal number. It's the same allocation for poll watchers who are permitted inside a voting location at any given time. So it's one per candidate, one per political party.
And that is while the votes are being counted, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Emily Previty is a WITS reporter who covers the election-related news. And as she said, and we'll look forward to that story, will be coming out about firearms and voting. But Emily, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You know, with so much confusion and disinformation being bandied about ahead of the election, WITF's news director Tim Lambert will be joining us every Tuesday for at least the next few weeks to answer your questions about finding information you can trust. He'll be discussing how WITF will cover things like the voting process and what we'll be reporting on election night. Now, Tim will be with me tomorrow to answer your questions. We encourage you to send them ahead of time. Send your questions to news@WITF.org. That's news@WITF.org. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. And all things regional, I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, not only will Tim Lambert be with us to talk about the election and answer your election-related questions and how WITF is covering the election and talk about the trusted sources and that sort of thing, but we also will be discussing an initiative by the Pennsylvania Department of Education to create more equity in Pennsylvania schools. That's coming up as well. One other election-related topic that we'll discover, we're going to be talking with some journalists from a few of the states that are considered battleground states. We're going to be talking with someone from Florida tomorrow and talk about the, you know, there's a lot of similarities between Florida and Pennsylvania as far as being a swing state. So we'll be talking with a journalist from Florida tomorrow. An immigrant rights group has released a study of a little more than 100 of its members aimed at providing a snapshot of the coronavirus pandemic's impact on Latinos in Pennsylvania. The group is Make the Road Pennsylvania. WITF's Latino Communities Reporter and Port for America fellow Anthony Orozco has reported on this. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me, Scott.
All right, so what did this survey find about Latinos in Pennsylvania?
So I attended the press conference, and one of the first things that they said was that this study shows or backs up what many people already know. That was their words. And really what it found is that immigrants, Latinos, are facing hardship when it comes to paying bills, that many of them are worried about how they're going to pay rent, and that a lot of them lost their job during the pandemic. Of course, I mean, that isn't something that only happened to the Latino community. But as we've seen in reports across the country, Latinos have taken a brunt. They've taken sort of a disproportionate hardship when it has come to the pandemic. And this report, like you said, was only 100 people being surveyed, but it did give us sort of a peephole look into what that means for Latinos here locally.
Mm-hmm. So you've kind of touched on this, but who are the people being surveyed and what that may mean?
So it is 106, I believe, members of Make the Road Pennsylvania. So that's a relatively small pool of people being surveyed when we talk about surveys in general. Usually when we see something that has to do, say, with the presidential election or any other sort of national matter, that's thousands or even tens or hundreds of thousands of people being surveyed. This is a very small pool, and it's of people who are already connected with Make the Road Pennsylvania, so who have some sort of activity or connection or established point of reference with this immigrant rights group.
Mm-hmm. So what was the purpose of the survey, and how does it play into Make the Road's work in Latino communities and in the political arena?
So the survey, I can't speak fully as to what the purpose was. I mean, the executive summary pretty much shows that this is to quantify what they've already seen, sort of anecdotally, from all of their members. And Make the Road is very large, to be quite honest. In Pennsylvania, here they report that they have, I think, around 10,000 members across the state. This focused on people in that archipelago of Latino cities, be it Philadelphia, Reading, Allentown, Whitehall. And really what it looks like to me is that this document supports their policy recommendation. So Make the Road is not only, it's sort of known for its quote-unquote rabble-rousing or, showing up to protest, but they also do a lot behind the scenes in the terms of policy, voter access, and other things. And in the study, they outline their policy recommendations. So the study, in part, is to quantify what they've heard and what people sort of maybe through quote-unquote common sense know what's happening to marginalized communities, but also it serves as a political document as to what they think our elected officials should be doing to help the Latino community.
Well, you just you anticipated my next question then, Anthony. What are some of those recommendations to help the Latino community?
Sure. So they break it down into federal and state and local. So some of those state and local things are like extending the state-funded Medicare or Medicaid to all Pennsylvanians, especially regardless of immigrant status. So about half of the people who were in this study are presumed undocumented. What increased language access for healthcare and services at testing sites, increased funding for community-based organizations with connections to immigrant communities to connect immigrants to healthcare services and providers. So that's on the state and local, and there's plenty more. That's just a handful. But in the federal side, they also reinforced sort of their stances on immigration, suspending immigration and custom enforcement activities and released detained individuals, reducing funding for ICE and for Customs and Border Protection, and provide for ending all funding for police in schools as well. So they have some lofty ideas for federal, and also some suggestions that are a little bit closer in reach for the state and local.
Okay, when you say ending all funding for police and schools, what do they mean by that?
Well, that goes into the section of divesting from immigration enforcement and sort of funneling those efforts and funds into helping the community. So when you stop having federal funding for police and schools, I am guessing, and I haven't had them expound on this, but the idea of policing in schools may also have negative effects for undocumented families who utilize those schools. That would discourage immigrant families from showing up to schools, or would maybe reinforce a lack of trust that they have in the system.
Some of those recommendations would be highly controversial, that's for sure. I mean, when you the first one that you mentioned, expanding Medicaid to undocumented immigrants into the U.S., I mean, that has been playing out as a campaign issue even in the presidential election. In the 2 minutes we have left, Anthony, just want to touch on something else. As part of your beat, if you will, you are covering Latino issues, but one you're looking at right now is the Route 222 corridor. Tell us about what you're looking at right now. You've already filed some reports for WYTF.
Yeah, so I traveled up and down the 222 corridor, which around here in Lehigh, Berks, and Lancaster counties is sort of known as the Latino corridor. This is hot spots for Latinos to come and settle, and also native Latinos in those urban areas. So I visited those cities, Lancaster, Reading, and Allentown, to tell stories about voters, candidates, and also immigrants who cannot vote in the lead up to the election, to gauge their concerns, their motivations for voting or not voting, or what they hope to see, even if they can't participate in the democratic process.
Anthony Orozco is WYTF's Latino Communities Reporter and Report for America Fellow. Anthony, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on something that Emily Previty, we were talking about the poll watchers, what they can, can't do, talk about voter intimidation, that sort of thing. Emily wanted to pass this along. If voters have a concern at the polls regarding poll watching, the Nonpartisan Election Protection Coalition has a phone number. And I don't know if you want to take this down or not. It probably is publicized some other places, but that phone number is 1-866-OUR-VOTE. 1-866-OUR-VOTE. And I think that's where you can report some things as well if you have a question. And she also wanted me to mention that, as she said during our conversation, that there will be a report coming up very soon on WYTF about firearms and the polls. You know, what's legal, what's not legal. Actually, during the program, we're getting a lot of election-related questions that were not directly, specifically related to our conversation today, but we will try to get some of those questions answered as well. Maybe Tim Lambert, who's coming up with us tomorrow, can answer some of these questions. So be sure to tune in. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good day.